You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. When the Twin Towers fell on September 11, 2001, nowhere were the reverberations more powerfully felt than at CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. Almost overnight, the intelligence organization evolved into a war-fighting intelligence service, constructing what was known internally as the Program, a web of top-secret detention facilities intended to help prevent future attacks on American soil and around the world. Now, the former deputy director of the CIA Counterterrorist Center, Philip Mudd, presents a full, never-before-told story of this now-controversial program, directly addressing how far America went to pursue Al-Qaeda and prevent another catastrophe. The book is called Black Site: The CIA in the Post-9/11 World. And today, Philip Mudd joins me on the show to talk about the radical transformation the intelligence community underwent in the first 90 days after 9/11, why the CIA was never intended to be in the business of housing and interrogating prisoners, and how they reached the decision to outsource the job to America's allies at so-called black sites. He discusses some of the 13 enhanced interrogation methods approved by the U.S. Justice Department and how they delineated between aggressive interrogation and torture. He reveals which techniques actually worked and how sometimes the carrot is more successful than the stick, even with terrorists. He says CIA operators express few regrets about what they did in the program, and many of them still feel thrown under the bus by members of Congress and former President Barack Obama. Plus, Philip reveals that some terrorists prefer the latest Harry Potter book over the Quran. Coming up with Philip Mudd in just a moment. Philip Mudd is the former deputy director at the CIA's Counterterrorist Center and the FBI's National Security Branch. He regularly appears on CNN and lectures all around the world on methodologies for understanding difficult analytic problems. His writings have appeared in Newsweek, The Wall Street Journal, The Atlantic, Foreign Policy, and The Washington Post, and he's the author of Takedown, a detailed account of intelligence gathering in the hunt for Al-Qaeda. Now he follows it up with his latest book, Black Site: The CIA in the Post-9/11 World. Philip Mudd, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me here on a hot summer day.
Well, you know, I want to begin by going back to that fateful day, September 11th, 2001. I believe that you were either in the White House personally or in the old executive office building, which is, of course, adjacent to the White House. What was that day like for you?
It's hard to describe it. It seems like nine lifetimes ago. I remember coming back with a cup of coffee and somebody saying a plane hit a building. I was in the executive office building, which is sort of looks like a wedding cake right next door to the White House. I came back. I assumed that the reports of a first plane were the tragedy of someone who was learning to pilot a Cessna or something and took a wrong turn. And then the second plane hit and somebody walked down the hall or ran down the hall and said, "We think there are more out there and there one might be coming for us," meaning for the White House. My assumption is that that was a reference maybe to the Shanksville plane, which I think was headed for the Congress. Anyway, we evacuated, and I walked out into a street scene in downtown Washington that was like a Hollywood set. People running around looking at bar TVs because nobody knew what was happening. Rumors were rampant. We thought that the State Department, which is not that far away, had been hit. And then maybe an hour or so later, I was going across the bridge and seeing the smoke billowing out of the Pentagon. It was just, it's, I feel like I didn't live it. It's so bizarre.
And it's almost become a platitude by now to say that everything changed on 9/11. But particularly from your vantage point, there really was a massive and fairly immediate overhaul. Behind the scenes in the White House and the intelligence agencies, what was it like in those first few months following 9/11?
For me, there was a group. I had not been working on terrorism at the White House, so I didn't have a good sense in the first couple days about what was going on. I don't remember how long it took, but I knew I wanted into the fight. Mm-hmm. So I remember calling back to my home agency, the CIA, in the midst of all. There was a real sense of sadness. I don't remember a sense of vengeance, but a sense that, you know, so many children had lost their parents. There are these photos of people jumping. So I called back to the CIA headquarters and said I wanted in the fight, and by October, so you're just talking about a few weeks later, I was on the CIA person on the U.S. government diplomatic team. There are only about half a dozen of us who were put together to ensure there was a new government in Afghanistan. There were on the inside, the sense of speed, the magnitude of the war, the decisions that were being made about how quickly to invade, send CIA guys in tomorrow. Just incredible decisions, faster than they could ever have happened before 9/11.
And I want to go back a bit and ask you to describe the CIA's counterterrorism center and the agency's broader approach to terrorism in the decade and a half leading up to 9/11. What was the mindset back then?
I think a lot of people, and this obviously is the prelude, the sort of the first chapter in the book, a lot of people, and I was there. I tried to write the book in the third person because I thought it would be confusing to jump back and forth, but I started in the Counterterror Center in 1992. The sense was that there was an emerging threat. We by the mid-1990s, Bin Laden was appearing on the radar. By the late 1990s, obviously, he was in Afghanistan, expelled from Sudan. But I think the people who were working on the problem, and I think this is what they told me when I was doing the dozens of interviews for the book, felt that they were making some progress, but they sort of had their finger in the dike, that we didn't have the capability to do things like major rendition operations, which, like it or not, became more and more prominent after 9/11. I think they thought that they had some capability, but it was not nearly enough to fight the adversary that they saw starting to grow in the early to mid-90s.
Mm-hmm. And my impression is that after 9/11, the pendulum sort of swung in the opposite direction, and the CIA went from being very risk-averse in the early 90s to saying, damn the torpedoes, let's do whatever it takes. Was there a real urgency to make up for lost time and swing all the way in the opposite direction?
I think that's a pretty accurate way to characterize it. I would not call the CIA risk-averse before 9/11. I would say the U.S. government and the American people simply weren't going to accept a policy that said, why don't we send troops into Afghanistan? Why don't we set up secret prisons around the world? Why don't we put armed drones in the air to kill terrorists? That would have been, you could not have considered that regardless of whether you're at CIA, the White House, or the State Department before 9/11. I think the attitude afterwards I could capture in just a couple sentences. Number one, this can never happen again. We cannot sustain another attack that maybe leads as many as 3,000 people dead. And the second, more specific to the CIA, would be if there is another event and you sit back and say, I wish I had done this, don't do that. Try to do that today. Don't wait for the day after. It was a very aggressive approach.
Yeah, and there's been a lot of controversy around the CIA's use of so-called black sites for housing and interrogating detainees. You get into that in this book. How did the CIA arrive at that decision?
That was another rapid, sort of under the broad umbrella of rapid decisions where there wasn't a lot of precedent and people didn't feel like they had a lot of time to figure out what the right path was. Mm-hmm. In the spring of 2002, the CIA captured their first major al-Qaeda player, a guy named Abu Zubaydah. We didn't, and I mentioned we because I was second in charge of CIA analysis on terrorism at that point. We didn't have a very good understanding of al-Qaeda. I think everybody in the business would have said that we're on our back foot, both operationally in terms of fighting them in the field, but also in terms of trying to explain al-Qaeda to the White House and how we were doing. when Zubeda was captured, there was a thought that he's going to know things that will, because he was a sort of facilitator for al-Qaeda, that will be extremely helpful. And eventually, when he stopped speaking, he said something like, you all can go home and have babies. I'm not speaking anymore. People started to say, what do we do? What are the choices that we have if he simply shuts down? And that's when people started to say, A, we think there's a way to go after him, which turned out to be interrogation techniques. And if we're going to do that, we have to have black sites, secret locations where we can hold these prisoners for extended periods of time so that nobody will know where they are.
You bring up an interesting point in that the CIA had really never been in the business of running prisons or what must have been an almost industrial-style interrogation operation. And that's just one example of how the CIA was suddenly thrust into this position of having to do jobs that historically had never been part of their portfolio.
And I think that's critical to understanding the backdrop to what happened in terms of the successes and failures of the prison interrogation program. The CIA ethos is pretty simple to explain. Unlike the military, or I also serve the FBI, it's not very hierarchical. There's not sometimes a tremendous amount of respect for authority, which occasionally can be humorous. Very agile, though. People have a belief that they have been given the authority, especially after 9/11, to make decisions in the field. Maybe to ask permission later. So you sacrifice a little bit of organizational rigor, maybe, of policies and procedures in favor, especially in an environment like that, of speed. So that leads people to say, we've never held prisoners before, but nobody else is going to hold these guys. We think we have to interrogate them. So therefore, for an agile organization, the simple decision is, we'll figure out how to do that ourselves. That has pluses, of course. The minuses, and this was especially evident early in the days of the Black Site program, were that the CIA, the administration of the first facilities wasn't great.
Yeah. And what did the CIA look for in the countries that housed these detainees?
You had to have some characteristics. One is an ally, that is a place that is not only going to allow you to keep prisoners, but is going to keep quiet about it, that's going to provide security for the facilities.
Yeah.
A place that hopefully wasn't going to come after you later and say, now we have some legal issues with the way you did this. So a place that might not have the kind of legal safeguards that a different kind of country would have. But primarily, you're talking about a close ally who's going to say, we have a facility you can use. We'll provide the security for it and nobody will talk about it. We can keep this very close hold in our country.
Now, let's talk about what you guys call the program. The CIA had, I believe, 13 enhanced interrogation techniques that had been approved by the Justice Department. What were the criteria for determining what was enhanced interrogation versus what was torture?
There was we went through days and months and then finally years of legal process in this. By years, I mean the initial guidelines from the Department of Justice for what the CIA could do to prisoners came out in August of 2002. And for years afterwards, there were continued efforts to narrow down those guidelines, tighten them, especially after we moved away from 9/11. The criteria matching the law were pretty the technical details took pages, but the criteria in layman's terms were, for high-end terrorists, torture is the purposeful effort to inflict long-term psychological or physical damage to a human being. For example, I personally believe that unless you do it for security purposes, holding someone in isolation for years is torture because you know that person is going to, and we do this in the United States all the time, solitary confinement in some of our federal prisons, because you know, again, unless that person is so dangerous they can't be let out, that person is going to suffer from long-term mental incapacitation. So the criteria for techniques like sleep deprivation would be, we do not believe, and based on some experience, we tried these to train people in the United States to resist interrogation overseas. These techniques are not designed and should not lead to long-term physical or psychological damage to a human being.
Of the 13 or so more aggressive techniques for interrogation, which ones were most effective?
I think they would tell you that one of the most effective would be sleep deprivation. Waterboarding is a focus. It's kind of, I don't want to say it's a red herring because, you know, American citizens did it to prisoners. It's appropriate for America to debate this, but we had more than 100 prisoners, or the CIA did, in sites. Mm-hmm. Three of them went through waterboarding. So there's a lot of debate about a tactic that wasn't used very often. Sleep deprivation was used often and was very effective. When you have people who are very fatigued, they want a way out, what the interrogators, I think, would call a lifeline. They want a lifeline out to more sleep. Mm-hmm. So they'll start giving stuff up in a state where they're very tired, giving stuff up that they think is a minor detail you can't use. Minor details in the world I used to live in can be gold. Even a fragment of a name can be gold. So, you know, it's not talked about in the public discourse, but sleep deprivation was used commonly and it was very effective. I'm not here to, it's a different question about whether people think it's appropriate. Mm-hmm. Just the technical question about what was used most often, that would be one.
And there was also a carrot and stick approach to interrogating detainees. What are some examples of the kind of rewards that they used and how effective they were?
Well, over time, and remember, some of these, the aggressive interrogation program typically is not going to last very long. Some prisoners will speak almost immediately. Some went through aggressive techniques for days, some for longer. But you're not talking about months or years of interrogation using those techniques. The advantages the prisoner gets over time, aside from the simple advantages of things like I'm not going to have to withstand sleep deprivation, would be better food. Maybe access to books, things that when you have nothing, start to look pretty significant. When you're eating a basic diet every day that has no variation, Ensure, for example, which is a nutritious drink that gives you all the nutrition you need but is not tasty, just food and books is pretty significant. So over time, those are the kinds of things that prisoners wanted.
Yeah, and I was really surprised to read that after the Quran, the most popular books with detainees were translations of the latest Harry Potter books. I would think that a book about wizardry and magic would be considered haram or forbidden in Islam.
It's every once in a while, I did maybe 35 or 40 interviews with people. These are typically people I knew. Mm-hmm. I don't name them in the book because I wanted them to talk. But every once in a while, we'd be sitting around with a cup of coffee and somebody would, one of the people I was interviewing would pop out with a fact like that. And I'd say, I got to put that in the book. I didn't know that back in the day when I was deputy director of counterterrorism. That's not the kind of thing that would typically come up. But when I heard that from one or two friends, I'm like, that's got to go in the book.
And what kind of preparation went into each individual enhanced interrogation?
Boy, let me give you a short answer, but a complicated question. First of all, you need the analytic capability to understand the person you're sitting across from. This is misunderstood in the public. You cannot determine whether someone's lying or misleading unless you have a good enough understanding about things like what they were doing in the previous year or two, where they had traveled to, who they communicated with, where they fit in the hierarchy. Unless you knew that, because typically you start with open-ended questions. When they don't answer them honestly, you know, the word we used was compliant, not honest, but compliant. That is, they're never going to tell you everything they know, but at least they're not going to lie in the answers they're giving you. Unless you have that background and an analyst who has every detail on what John Doe, the terrorist, has done, you can't really begin an interrogation process. The second step is a team. That team is at the site. That includes the site, the black site. That includes the site manager, physicians, psychologists, interrogators, analysts, to combine the questions of who is this individual, this terrorist we're sitting across? What are they vulnerable to? But also, what's their individual psychology? Where are they in the interrogation cycle? How compliant have they been so far? Are they close to as compliant as we think they will be? So after every interrogation and before every interrogation, there's a team process to say, what's next for this individual person? This is not a one-stop shopping kind of process, which is one reason there are so few black site prisoners. It was very labor-intensive for the agency.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Philip Mudd when we come back in just a minute. Imagine yourself with a doctoral degree, at the top of your field, teaching, researching, or making a big impact in your community. A doctorate is a huge step forward to achieving your goals. So what's stopping you? A doctoral degree may seem out of reach because of the investment involved, be it a time investment or a financial one. But you could earn your degree from Capella University through their flexible program with online classes and a dedicated community of faculty and students just like you. If you're worried about the cost of your degree, Capella is there to help too. Eligible students enrolling in select doctoral programs may qualify for a $5,000 or $10,000 scholarship. In addition to scholarships, Capella has a team of financial aid counselors, enrollment counselors, and career counselors to help you make your goal a reality. Because you are an investment that's worth it. Learn more about the support and resources you'll have from beginning to end. You can also start by exploring Capella's programs and scholarship opportunities at capella.edu/kick. That's Capella, capella.edu/kick. White Castle is America's first fast food hamburger chain, as well as the slider experts. And now you can get White Castle sliders in the grocery store. Made with 100% beef patties on a bed of steam-grilled onions, they have the same one-of-a-kind taste that White Castle has been serving in their restaurants for years. And whether you're a vegetarian or a meat eater, White Castle sliders come in a whole bunch of tasty varieties for just about anyone to enjoy. Feeling a little cheesy? Try their cheese sliders. Looking to add a little spice to your life? Just have a taste of their jalapeno cheese sliders. One bite and you'll understand what all the crave's about. My whole life I've heard Midwesterners carrying on about White Castle with the kind of enthusiasm usually reserved for the local NFL team. Growing up in Texas and California, I always wondered what the fuss was about. Then, a few years ago, I was in Chicago one night and I insisted that my buddy there take me to a White Castle. That's when I got hooked on their cheese sliders. There's just something so simple and satisfying about meat, cheese, and onions on a pillowy and delicious little bun. So you can imagine my heartbreak when I came back to California and there wasn't a White Castle to be found. I can't tell you how many nights I've been craving those cheese sliders, so I was thrilled when White Castle came to the rescue with sliders in my local grocery store. Now, folks, White Castle burgers are iconic, and you know their fans like me are pretty obsessive, but I'm happy to report that these sliders really do live up to the name White Castle. Just 60 seconds in the microwave, and I'm having that same authentic White Castle experience I had that night so many years ago in Chicago. They even have breakfast sliders with a variety of flavors, perfect for when you need a quick hot breakfast on the go. From the castle or the grocery store, you can satisfy your crave anytime with White Castle. Go to whitecastle.com/kick to get $1 off the purchase of any 4 or 6-pack White Castle sliders. You know, folks, one of my favorite ways to unwind at the end of the day is with a good cigar. Somehow, time just seems to slow down. You can think and savor the moment a little more. That's because smoking a good cigar is an experience. But like wine, it can be intimidating to get started, but not with Puro Trader. Puro Trader makes the global cigar market easily accessible right from your laptop or mobile device. Puro Trader is like one of those travel sites that searches the entire web for the best deals, except instead of flights, you're searching for cigars. From everyday cigars for the casual smoker to the rarest of the rare sticks for the collectors. And it's all in a supportive community setting where you can ask questions and read real reviews. Buying cigars and entering the community just got a whole lot easier with Puro Trader. Whether you're on the hunt for a rare, unique cigar or just looking to get started, Puro Trader is the only destination you need to get educated, monitor market trends, and join the conversation. Check out PuroTrader.com and use the promo code NEWS for a chance to win a day at the Porsche Racing Experience in Los Angeles or Atlanta. That's PuroTrader, PuroTrader.com, promo code NEWS. And now, back to the show. And once the U.S. entered the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, I have to assume that the steady flow of detainees must have increased dramatically, and with it, the demand for more interrogators. Was there any loosening of the criteria or training for them in order to meet that need?
Yes, you can think of the process that we developed. We, the CIA, developed black sites and developed interrogators in sort of three stages. The first stage is pretty rough. After going, you know, into 2002 and going into 2003, then there's a maturation stage of how you build a facility, how you train people, even setting up a formal training program for individual interrogators. I don't think with the first detainee in 2002, the CIA guys thought they'd have to build other facilities. I know they didn't think that they would have as many detainees as they eventually got, because we didn't think the success rate against the al-Qaeda leadership would be anything like it was in 03 and 04. I mean, we started really cranking in those years. And when you start to capture people, the 0.1% of the top, the guys that we wanted in the Blackside program, it was just a lot of them. The program matured. The training process matured. The legal guidance kept maturing again and again, especially when there are mistakes. The lawyers would say, this can't happen again. Communications between the field and headquarters on the administration of facilities for the long-term detention of prisoners, when we realized there wasn't a way out for some of these guys until President Bush announced they're being transferred to Guantanamo. So yeah, a real maturation process.
And as the demand for interrogators increased, the CIA actually began recruiting female interrogators. I have to imagine that that also added a psychological component to interrogation as well.
Yes, it did. I mean, a lot of the workforce at the Counterterror Center was female. A lot of the expertise that the Counterterror Center had on al-Qaeda was female. So this wasn't necessarily an effort to make a detainee uncomfortable. It's just a security service that has a program that's expanding rapidly, saying, who are our best qualified people in the service to talk to this growing cadre of detainees we have? So I'm sure it looks on the surface like we're trying to rub the detainees' noses into it. That's a simplistic interpretation of what was happening. The CIA workforce going into the first decade of the 2000s was pretty well mixed between men and women.
Did the CIA also have to be particularly alert to any applicants who maybe wanted the job too much?
Yes, I talked to some of the black site managers and the managers of the program at CIA headquarters in Langley, and their message was pretty basic. If you have someone who walks into an interview and says, I can't wait to get at this, I really want to show these guys who's boss, that is going to be a mark or a piece of a conversation that leads that person to be disqualified for the process. I'm not saying the events that happened at black sites were polite. What I am saying is you want somebody who's going to go in and say, this is difficult. This is very controversial. People will be looking at that this 6 ways till Sunday in the years down the road. We can't have people who walk in saying, I want my piece of the action and I want to sit face to face with the terrorist and show them who's boss. That's a recipe for a problem.
I was interested to read that many CIA operatives refused to let junior officers participate in interrogations. It sounds like they knew that what they were doing would eventually become public, and they were trying to protect their subordinates from the inevitable criticism.
I think there's a couple. It's a little subtler than that. We knew, and I'll say we because I was aware of this at this time, we knew that we would be vilified. Mm-hmm. I don't think we could have anticipated some of that. And all of us were surprised, for example, by how quickly Congress decided that they were uncomfortable with the program. But there is a different piece of this. The CIA's business typically is to collect intelligence overseas via clandestine sources. So that's someone involved in a nuclear program, someone involved in a rogue regime overseas, to meet people clandestinely and manage them clandestinely so the U.S. government can get information about adversaries.
Interesting.
You train people to do that for decades. That is not interrogating prisoners. So there was also this sense that junior officers going up through the process, operations officers, what we say, the people posted overseas, need to learn the business. Mm-hmm. They need to get out in the field and practice traditional spy craft, because eventually the CIA is going to get back into that.
And it sounds like it wasn't just the interrogators who were aware of the public relations angle of this and that eventually what they were doing would become public, but also al-Qaeda as well. I think you say al-Qaeda members were taught to resist divulging information and told what to expect, but more than that, they were actually encouraged to be combative with interrogators and try to, I guess, goad them into crossing lines and using violence. They seem to have been keenly aware of the public relations consequences the CIA faced.
They did go through some of them through some counterinterrogation training. It's not clear to me how extensive that was. There were guidebooks for that circulating in extremist circles. We did have, I remember, one senior detainee came in and said, I'm going to lawyer up. I want my lawyer. One reason you had a black site is you can't lawyer up at a black site. But they were aware of the U.S. judicial system and how they could potentially, if they were brought into the judicial system, never say anything. So especially among the higher end guys. And I got to tell you that one of the not surprises, one of the things that might be curious to a listener was Some of the senior al-Qaeda people were among the brightest, most dedicated individuals. You would think they'd be sort of radicals or nutty. That was not the case. You take Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who's the architect of 9/11, probably the most senior detainee that was ever held at a CIA facility. He was very bright. So they thought through strategies to resist. They thought through how they could try to hold the most secret information they had. I think some of them, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, never truly said anything about the secrets they thought were most significant, including bin Laden. That's why I used the word compliant before. They were never truly, fully honest. So, yeah, they were tough. He was really tough.
And I wonder, what did you and the others in the agency think when President Obama took office and referred to these methods as torture and accused some in the CIA of having behaved unethically or even having betrayed American values?
I was discouraged, and I think a lot of my colleagues were discouraged. There's a difference between the president coming in and saying, we won't do this again. I think that's perfectly appropriate. The American people elect this the president. He had been clear on that before the election. To come in and say, not only will we not do this again, but I think what's happening was inappropriate. I don't agree with the previous administration. I would say that's his right. I don't begrudge him that. When you use the word torture, a couple of things for people like me that come up are, first of all, I realize that people think we're hiding, but we did seek legal guidance. And the legal guidance was, this complies with the U.S. constitutional law. And we sought legal guidance, if you read the book, again and again and again, in addition to advising the Congress, the people who passed the laws, who didn't object to what we're doing, with the exception of some. John McCain, for example, objected to what we were doing. Right. But for someone to come in afterwards and say, well, actually, not only am I going to shut this down, but I've decided unilaterally that you guys got legal guidance that was bad and therefore you violated federal law and the Constitution, that's a little painful.
Yeah, because it's not like the CIA didn't have oversight and approval from the president at the time, the Justice Department, many in Congress knew as well. And then once it all became public, it kind of reminded me of Claude Rains in Casablanca. Suddenly, all these congressmen and senators are so shocked that there were CIA black sites and such a thing as enhanced interrogation. Do some of the operators feel betrayed and thrown under the bus by Washington?
Yes. And that's one reason why when you see the debate today, and one reason the book is important, I think, is to remind people of the kind of challenges that decision makers and intelligence community decisions and intelligence community positions have to make. You know, there's a current debate about who should be the director of national intelligence. People, I think, knew that there would be serious questions. We weren't naive, but the key point, I think, one of the key points was the origins of the Iraq War, the unity after 9/11, including in the Congress, including in the Intelligence Oversight Committee, started to fall apart. So within, 2 years of the creation, that's a guesstimate number, of the creation of the black sites, you had congressional hearings that were incredibly contentious. Yeah. So I think people were surprised at the speed with which the people started to ask questions in Congress, but also how they started to say, we didn't know. I dispute, not a lot of them knew, in fact, very few about the program, but they knew a fair amount of detail.
Yeah, and curiously, that 2014 Senate report didn't even include interviews with any CIA officers. Is that part of the reason that you wrote this book, to give voice to those who couldn't speak for themselves?
I wasn't objecting to the Senate report. I have issues with it that I mentioned in the book. I was, there's a simple reason for the book. One is, I'm an English major and I like words, and I was running one day and I realized there's a story out there that needs to be told. It's a tiny sliver of history. An incredible, incredibly tense history for the U.S. intelligence community and decision-making about how the U.S. got in the intelligence guys got into and out of the black side business that nobody will ever tell. And the people I spoke with, many of them have never and will never speak with a member of the media. I spoke with them because I had worked with them, and I told them this is going to be confidential. The book is not a defense. If you read it, there's stuff that's critical, that is negative about how the program was run. But I thought it was just a sliver of history that was gonna disappear if I didn't tell it. And so I just wanted to write the book. I wasn't out to attack anybody or to sort of go after the Senate report. I just wanted to tell the story.
Mm-hmm. And among the participants in the program that you've talked to today, do many of them express any regrets about what they did?
I didn't hear regrets, and this was a pretty universal view. I didn't hear regrets about the program. There were a few questions from a few saying, if I had to go back, we might have reconsidered waterboarding. But that was one of, again, that was used on three people out of 100 plus. That's because it became such a lightning rod in the public debate afterwards. They're like, we could have done this without the waterboarding process. There was also a sense that we should have pushed, that the CIA should have pushed the White House harder to expand the number of members of Congress who knew about this and were briefed on it. The White House was adamant that we not brief a lot of members of Congress. But these are pretty minor details. And the overarching question I asked this of everybody I spoke with, I had a list of questions that everybody got. One of them was ethics and afterthoughts, and that included, you know, what kind of regrets you have. I think a lot of them would say on September 12th of 2001, we thought maybe another 3,000 people would die. We called it the second wave, and we thought it might be anthrax. And they look back and say, it didn't happen, and they're proud of that.
Here we are now, I guess, coming up on two decades since 9/11. And one question that comes to my mind is, where are all of these detainees now? Whatever became of them?
No, they were moved to the announcement by President Bush going back now more than 10 years. That they were moved to Guantanamo. And some of them are still there, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. There are questions now about his legal process, actually, just in the past couple of weeks. But yeah, they shifted over to Guantanamo.
And what is the long-term plan? I guess a lot of these people you can't release back into the wild, so to speak. So is it just indefinite detention?
Boy, that is one of the things we struggled with as early as at least 2003, maybe as early as the year the program was established in 02, but at least 03, people started talking about the phrase we used was endgame. Mm-hmm. What are we going to do with these people? We're not jailers, we're interrogators. We're still having that debate about Guantanamo today. Guantanamo, in a way, parallels some of the black site problems. Once you bring these people in, like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, if you don't have the information to try them in a U.S. court of law, do you let them go? Mm-hmm. There's a very few people in that category, I think. I think most of the people at Guantanamo have gone through some sort of legal process or have been sent back to their home countries. But there's a slice of the top echelon of Al-Qaeda that I think might be there for a long time to come. I don't know if that's a good decision. I actually would question it, but I think that's what's going to happen.
Well, as we wind down here, I have to ask about your old boss, Robert Mueller. You were hired
by
him.
Love that guy.
And yeah,
yes.
And you met with him every day when you were with the FBI. What did you think about how he was treated in the congressional hearings and how he handled those questions?
I thought it was pitiable. He gave 50 years of service, starting with Vietnam. He served as a prosecutor in San Francisco. He left private practice to go prosecute murders at the Department of Justice. He became one of the most storied FBI directors in history under President Bush. He was so good that President Obama said, "Can you stick around? I can't replace you." It was not his request to serve as special counsel. He laid a report on the table that was excruciating in detail and damning of some of the president's activities, and he was treated horribly by the Congress. I realized maybe he didn't have his A game. They knew that. He served at the Americans' request, and they abused him. I thought it was pitiable, mm-hmm. pitiable.
It's been interesting to watch how the president and his allies in Congress have tried to paint Bob Mueller as some kind of a rogue agent who was somehow politically motivated to go after Trump, even though he's a registered Republican and was appointed by Republican presidents. In all your time working with Bob Mueller, has he ever shown any political bias?
I mean, I have to start that with a few funny comments. I was with him for 4.5 years, sometimes multiple times a day, white button-down shirt every day. Every single day. Never saw him in a pair of khakis, dark suit every day. Tie up black shoes every day. To have an idea that this guy, a storied, and I think maybe the most storied public prosecutor of a generation or two, maybe the second most storied FBI director in history, to have him painted as a rogue operator is, if it weren't so serious, it's humorous. Mm-hmm. But I don't understand how people who know him. I mean, I understand Washington. It's a place where if you want a friend, you got to get a dog. But how somehow the president has managed to portray an American hero as a rogue agent is odd.
Well, again, the book is called Black Site: The CIA in the Post 9/11 World. Philip Mudd, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks for having me today.
Thanks again to Philip Mudd for coming on the podcast. Order his new book, Black Site, The CIA in the Post-9/11 World, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. And keep up with Philip at philmudd.com. Folks, most of my life I've heard about White Castle. Growing up in Texas and California, it was the kind of thing I remember Midwesterners raving about. Then one night, I was in Chicago, and I finally got to see what all the fuss was about. Those simple and delicious cheese sliders got me hooked. But when I came home to California, there wasn't a White Castle restaurant to be found. Good news, though, White Castle came to my rescue with White Castle sliders available at the grocery. Made with 100% beef patties steamed on a bed of grilled onions, they have the same one-of-a-kind taste White Castle has been serving in their restaurants for years. Pick up some sliders from the grocery store and make it a slider night. Go to whitecastle.com/kick to get $1 off the purchase of any 4 or 6-pack White Castle sliders. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.